Alan Crane Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for Autumn Semester 2022.
Today,
risk and return.
Yeah, something like that. Now, I see my battery is dying here, so I'll have to move quickly. I may lose my feed today. But first things first, as far as the exam goes, you did actually quite well on that compared to the fussing and worry that you had. The average was about a 79%. What I'm going to do is I'm going to quickly just show you the questions, bitch about a couple, and there's one I'm kind of on the borderline of whether I'm going to throw that one out and give you all credit, so you might get a couple more points. It was like a 50% hit rate on it, and that's a little uncomfortably low for me, so you might see your score pop up a little bit because of that one. But other than that, you did okay. I'm impressed by how you did. So really quickly, just to give you the heads up on what happened during that exam, the hit rate on the math questions was very high, which just makes my heart warm and my diaper damp. So where the hell was I? Oh, here we go. And midterm exam, inactive. Edit. Whoops, I don't want to do that. Give me a second here. And I'm just going to quickly go through just a few highlights on that fun thing that was your final your exam. And, okay, give me a second here. Wow, the average was pretty good on this. Okay, now, just a few of them. These were ones where most of you hit it right on the head. These multiple choice questions. Obviously, future expected costs are what we care about, none of that other stuff. And the least of the current assets. You'll notice that a lot of these, I even telegraphed, this is what I'm going to ask in the review session. That's why these review sessions are so important. It's because I'll give you information that is very useful to you. This one was a little bit on the lower side. Borrowing money from a friend, pay it back in 2 years. 2 years, that's a note. So that meant that you could actually remove all of them but two. There were only two that had a note in them. And since you're the borrower, you're the issuer, that solves it, that it's A. Use a process of elimination on my multiple choice questions because that's going to get you a long way with these. Now, corporations don't have to pay dividends, and most of you got it. That was nice. Okay, and this goes back to the difference between accounting and finance. Finance is that financial statements, which are done by accountants, don't reflect economic costs. They never do. They reflect accounting costs, which are historical costs. Okay. That was, almost everyone got this one, it looks like. Yeah, that one was a real high hit. And a company must reinvest. No, that's just a repeat kind of the other one, and score was pretty high on that one as well. This one, I won't mention too many names here, but common stock is forever. That's capital. That's the ultimate in capital. In other words, long-term funds. So, I'm not going to apologize for that at all. This one was one just from the quiz, and of course, really high hit rate on that one. And this one, again, you got it this time. It was the last time we had stagflation. Before now was Carter. Now, we may be slipping into a stagflation again now. That would be the first time in your lives. As a matter of fact, God, I hate to say this. I don't think even your parents saw this stagflation in 1980. So this is a very new experience for the last couple of generations where you have a high inflation and the economy is not moving very well. Right now, though, the economy still seems to be doing pretty well. So, there's that. Now, ROA is less than ROE because return, both of them have net income in the numerator, but in the denominator, ROA has all of the assets, but in ROE, only the equity. The liabilities aren't there, so that means that the denominator is smaller in ROE, so the result is a higher number. By the way, some of these questions I copy and paste and put on your final exam. So it's worth it for you to go back through and make sure you know the right answers to this one, to what's on here. Corporations, and almost everyone nailed that one to the wall. That was excellent. This one was not, it had its share of difficulties, and it might be, it was above 50%, but future value of an annuity due, since your payments are starting at the end of the period, at the beginning of the periods, that means that they are gathering more interest than if they're, you're putting in money at the end of the period. So the future value of an annuity due will be larger. That's the false statement. It said it would be less. I'm almost worried that there, maybe the wording of that statement was a little bit opaque. Okay, no default premium. Anything that's U.S. Treasury isn't going to have a default premium. And then you buy and sell stock in secondary markets. We don't participate in the primary where the company's issuing it. We buy it from some other fool, or we sell it to some greater fool than ourselves. And then the decrease in free cash flow, simply because as you add inventory, you're absorbing cash, you're using cash, so that decreases free cash flow. And actually, normally that question doesn't get such a high rate of people getting it right. So in general, assets with lower liquidity will have higher expected returns. That's that whole thing I did in the class and then in the review, and most of you got it. This one, The only thing that I could see was that some of you got it wrong because, and it was because you put it on end instead of beginning, so you got partial credit for it, for that. If you put it on, if the number that you got was one that I identified as just the mistake at the bottom, so you got partial credit there. IBs, investment banks, are the ones, as I had said, issuance of common stock. They buy it up from the companies. This one, I was actually a little surprised by this one. The net present value, if it's equal to zero, that means that you hit the internal rate of return. The discount rate you used was the internal rate of return, because the internal rate of return is a discount rate that makes the NPV zero. I was expecting that one to have a lower, I think about 67% of you got that one right. I was expecting a little less. This is a repeat. ROE is less than ROA. No, it's always larger. Okay, bearish. For God's sake, some of you said bullish and one person said doggish. Who does that? I mean, were you high? Okay. Bondholders have the prior claim. Good hit rate on that one. This one was actually as I have said several times, the bond market is 10 times the size of the stock market. We just don't hear about it because it's not very sexy. It's not, the prices don't move very much in it. Intrinsic value of a type of money is inversely related to its liquidity. If it's low liquidity, it's going to have a high intrinsic value, like a house or a person. If it has high liquidity, you're not going to make anything off it. It's in your pocket. Eight people put accounting. God, that bunches my boxers. Accounting, really? Do I look like an accountant? You look like an accountant. Burned out accountant, but an accountant. MRO, the Marathon Oil thing, almost all of you got it. I mean, although a couple of you put the price instead of the actual 100 times the value here, that was a little bit disturbing to me. But other than that, most of you got all of these a lot riskier. I made it so that it was obviously a ridiculously risky stock, and it was obviously a way below normal PE ratio. So there were definitely not in agreement there. The beta is saying this is risky, really risky, and the PE ratio was saying it's not risky at all. I mean, you could buy MRO and probably do pretty well over the next few months with it. Okay, matching, almost all of you got it, straight up all of the answers. The problem, of course, is if you get one wrong, you get two wrong. But that didn't happen very much. It was like 90% of you got all five of them right. And then these, just the classic. I mean, 97% got these right. 97 to 98% of you got these right. And that was the one that was always the worry. Of course, the math is always where you will have the worst problems. And you finally got it down. And that was awesome. So give yourself a pat on the butt or a back or whatever and move on from there with your lives. Now, again, midterm questions do show up on the final, especially if they hit core objectives of the course. You know, obviously, you'll get the monthly payments thing and the future value thing, and you'll get some of the things with liquidity and all that kind of stuff. So make sure that you have this and go through it as part of your review for the final exam in this class. And I think they've just released the final exam time, so I'll get those up on your schedules as well. Moving along here. My battery's still running. Okay, here we go. Oh my goodness, here we go. Okay. Oh, is this a bull day or a bear day, sir?
Bull day.
It is a very bull day. I'm actually pulling my butt out of, I was losing money over in that bear market last week. It was just a slaughter, and I've climbed up a lot today. Look at those numbers. I mean, that is hardcore. Interestingly enough, though, notice that after the initial spike, it just kind of leveled off. That was the result of the earnings of banks coming out today, and it was a very strong day for the banks, and that just made everyone happy for a little while. But after that, there really wasn't any more information that came out, good or bad, so the market just leveled off, and it was happy to just stay there. One thing that can happen is that you have an initial spike up, but then the profit taking starts with the bears and it goes back down. Today, the bears had no taste for going in and attacking. They just sort of left it there and it's just floating to the end. What's going to happen tomorrow is anyone's guess, because you could have the bears come in just lying in wait to come in the overnight or the pre and slam everything down. I don't see that happening because I don't think there's any more bad news that's coming out. So we may have a quiet day tomorrow, or we might have another bull surge as secondary buyers see that there was a good day and they come in and grab up some stuff themselves. It's hard to tell, though. But as far as anything else goes, now, thank heaven, crude was pushing upward. And that was largely the result of the OPEC Plus saying that they were going to cut the supplies. The other side of that, of course, is that there are others. Most people don't take OPEC too seriously, at least in the long run, because if they all cut their production, that pushes the prices up. And then, of course, that gives incentive to the individual members of OPEC Plus, the incentive, of course, to go in there and start opening up the oil again to make money off the higher prices. So, and then there's also other factors involved here, too. One factor that is in the game is that for a long time, we have had serious limits on what oil we will buy from Venezuela. Venezuela is a very large producer of oil. And we have always punished Venezuela because it had a leftistic elected president. And then we punished them more because they were unstable. We are now in serious talks to essentially warm up the relations with Venezuela so that we can take advantage of their oil production, and that will soften the blow of the OPEC plus nations cutting their oil supplies. So crude is not spiking which some traders thought it would. Now, it's staying in that band, 82 to 89. Remember I told you about that band? It's staying right in there because there's no real news that's telling us that it's going to go, the market's going to go crazy. Commodities, did you see this? Gold just wailed upward, and then it skidded right back down in the day. I got these emails from these fool gold traders telling me, now's the time to buy, the apocalypse is on us. And by the end of the day, those emails had stopped because gold was collapsing in price again. And silver was doing about the same thing, but silver doesn't really go that speculative. Okay, now the bonds. The bonds dropped, yields dropped hard, which means that the prices were going up at first today, and then as the market showed that it was equities were a good investment, investors pulled out of the bonds, prices went down, yields came back up again a little bit. And they finished almost flat. What? They moved up about a half of a basis point. Big whoop. And London is showing some signs of a recovery because their new prime minister, who had initially made some very big mistakes on economic policy, has reeled back in her rhetoric, and some of her cabinet ministers have repeated that they're not going to be crazy like everyone thought they were earlier. So London had a fairly decent day. Tokyo, on the other hand, started down. It just dropped right off the bell. But then from there, it just sort of sat there because there wasn't any bad news after the opening. So it just kind of sat there in negative territory all day. So there's what the market's been like through the day today. Nothing exciting. Well, for me, it's very exciting. Finally, we have a good bull market rolling along. So that's that. How long is that going to last? Well, it's hard to tell right now, but fortunately, we're in a decent bull market for the time being. Okay, enough of all that. I had a few last things to talk about bonds. I'm going to show you some calculator routines again. Trust me, this is how you do the bond math. If you want to do this with tables or on paper with a basic calculator, you're going to be in for a lot of work, because in one of the two types of problems, you literally have to calculate over and over again to find a close enough answer to be happy. So it's worth it for you to know how to do it on the calculator. Now remember what the basics of this. With bonds, you have parameters that you need to know for a bond. The first thing is that the face value of every bond is $1,000. You will not be told that, you just know that. That's the assumption. And so if a company issues $100,000 in long-term bonds, that technically means that they issued 100 bonds. Yeah, 100 bonds. So we always put into the calculator the FV is 1,000, the future value. You're going to get your $1,000. You lent the company $1,000, you'll get $1,000 back at the end. Whoops. This is Apps Finance, and it's the TVM solver. We keep going back to this one. Now, a bond has a term. That's how much time is left on the bond. So if I tell you that it is, for example, a TGT 4.2% 2030, the term is 8 years. That's how much time it has left. That's the years remaining. put in the years remaining. And it's the way I sometimes do it, if it's a long time, I take the maturity year minus 2022. That's how I do it, just so I am not trying to count 1, 2, 3, 4 years and all that. Okay, so now, the PV is the price of the bond. You'll either be given the price or you will calculate the price. Remember to put it in as a negative value. Now the payment, the PMT, is going to be the coupon as a decimal times 1,000. That's all you do. Face value coupon is always expressed as a percent of face value. And then the FV is the 1,000. Make sure that that bottom thing is on end and leave everything else alone. Make sure they're all on ones and all that. So, then also I forgot, of course, the I percent is the yield on the bond. You either are given the yield or you calculate the yield. These two, you'll be given one and you calculate the other. CVS, 3.125%, 2029. Right now, let's say the yield to maturity, YTM, is 3.30%. The market is saying that CVS should be paying 3.30%, but it's paying only 3.125%. So we know I percent. We know it. And so we put it into the calculator. N is the number of years remaining, which in this case would be 7 years. I percent is the YTM. Don't confuse that with the coupon. Somewhere in big letters in your note, write down YTM. That is the yield to maturity. Do not use the coupon there. And then the price value, we don't know that. That's what, if we're given the yield to maturity, then that means that we want to find the price. Don't delete it. Don't do anything like that, okay? Just leave whatever, if there's a number there, zero or some number, other number, just leave it. Don't delete it, for God's sake, or you'll start getting errors all over the place. Now, the payment, you do it as a decimal point, 03125 times 1,000. That's all you do. FV for bonds, unless it's some really weird bond, is going to be 1,000. Make sure everything else is 1, 1, and go back up to the PV, alpha, solve. It's $989.22. That's the price. Now, if I say quote it, you take a tenth of that and don't put a dollar sign on it because it's no longer a dollar. It's just a device we use. So you would probably hear a trader say, yeah, CVS 3125 2029 is currently quoting at 98.02. That's not the price. So be sure you know what I'm asking for, price or quote. On the next quiz, I could do it either way. I could give you the quote as, or you find the price, whatever. Now, one twist on this. There's just a twist. Bonds actually don't pay the coupon every year. They pay it in two installments. They pay it in two installments. To adjust the formula, to adjust what I did, if it's a real bond, you would take the number, the term times two. Because then there'd be, instead of seven payments, there'd be 14. And the yield would be divided by two. Remember how we did that before? Times and divide. The payments, you'd get $31.25 in two pieces. So you would divide the payment by two. And then you go up and find the present value. It is very much the same. It's just a little bit less. Now, the way I'm going to do it on a quiz and an exam is that I will put the range so that you can do it either as semi-annual payments or as annual, and you'll get the right answer. If you want to do it realistically, yeah, you'll get the right answer. If you want to do it just annually, you'll get the right answer, okay? Because in general, this is not a very big difference. It usually becomes noticeable if the bond has a long time left, like 20 years, 25 years. It can become noticeable if the spread between coupon and yield is big. It's not really that big here, and there's not much time left on the bond anyway. So that's how you would deal with the semi-annual part. It's not something that you need to worry about for my tests and quizzes. Okay, so now this one, there's a formula you can use to do this, and the tables can do this. Accounting tables can do this one relatively efficiently, not nearly as fast as a calculator can. The other side of this is when you know the price, but you don't know the yield. That's when it gets to be a pain in the butt to do it with tables or with just the formula, because you have to keep trying different yields to find the one that works. Look at this one. JBD, 4.65%, 20.33, with a price right now of $1,011.16. In this case, we have to find the yield to maturity. And this is when it gets to be, if you did this by hand, you just have to keep trying different yields to maturity until you get approximately $1,011. We can do it a lot better. 2033 is 11 years. We don't know the I percent, just leave it alone. The price, we do know. The price, don't forget to give a negative whenever you have a PV, is $1,011.16. And your coupon is 0.0465 times 1,000. Remember, it's a coupon as a decimal times 1,000 every time. FV is always 1,000. Everything else looks good, so we go up here to I percent, alpha, solve. 4.52% is the yield to maturity. Now, I want you to notice something. In the first problem, the market said the coupon should be more than what it is. The yield is above the coupon. In that case, you notice that the price is above 1,000, is below 1,000. We say that the bond is selling at a discount to par. It's selling below $1,000 because the market is punishing the bond because the bond's coupon isn't as much as it should be. In the second one, we found out that the yield to maturity was less than what the company was paying. The market's saying, you need to pay us 4.52%. Oh, you pay us more than that, so this bond is going to sell at a premium to par. It's going to, if the yield is below the coupon, then the price is going to be above 1,000. We say that the bond is selling at a premium to par. Now, obviously, as these two numbers, as the yield and the coupon get farther apart, the bond's price will be much more and more away from the $1,000. Let me say that again. As the bond's yield to maturity and the coupon get farther apart, the bond will sell further away from par. Watch this one. Suppose that the yield to maturity was 4.25. It was even lower, even further from the coupon. Notice that the premium gets bigger. That's an important thing. Let me show you something else interesting here. Watch what happens when the number of years, the term, gets smaller. Let's take the number of years down to 6 years. Let's look at the price. Let's take it down to 3 years. Look at the price. Let's take it down to 1 year left. Do you see how as a bond approaches maturity, as a term approaches zero, the price approaches par, $1,000. Let me say that again. As a bond approaches maturity, in other words, as a term approaches zero, the bond's price approaches par. It doesn't matter whether it was at a discount to par or a premium to par. If bonds are healthy, they come toward par as you get closer to the time that the bond matures. The reason is simple. When the bond matures, you're going to get $1,000. So as you get closer to that time, the bond is going to sell closer to $1,000. As a matter of fact, if we go to the ridiculous example, at the end, it sells at par. That's what all bonds do. Now, this is a question. Watch it. I do this as a multiple choice question. As a bond, as the term of a bond approaches zero, the bond, and the answer is, approaches par. Just know that's what you're looking for, or approaches $1,000. Just know that that's what I'm asking, and just aim, don't look at all the other answers, just say la, 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 just look for the one that says that it's approaching $1,000, okay? Now, there are other things about this, too. There's a kind of bond that's called a callable bond. That's a bond. Let's say that JBD bond is callable in 2028. That means that in 2028, the bond can be paid. Just ended right there. It can be called back. So if you're ever asked for a yield to call, make N the number of years to the call. So if I ask for the yield to call on that, what I would do, let's say that it's callable in 2028. That's 6 years from now. So in that case, what I would do is I would, this I percent, I would be calculating the yield to call. My ass. Oh, I was just testing you on that. Kill it with fire. Let's say it's 1011, 12. Alpha solve. Sorry about that. So the yield to call, usually, I got to be careful about this. Usually the yield to call will be a little bit less than the yield to maturity because there's less time left on the bond. The yield to call, do companies usually call their bonds in? Interestingly enough, right now, there are several different versions of this. The book distinguishes between call and put on a bond. One way or the other, when interest rates get way away from where they were when the bond was issued, you can assume that something's going to be done with that bond. Like right now, interest rates are going up. So the lenders are going to try to call the bond in so the company has to pay them off so they can reinvest at a higher rate now. I mean, heck, there are bonds back when interest rates were super low a few years ago. They have call provisions in the mid-2020s, late-2020s. And if interest rates stay way up there, then the investors, the lenders, are going to say, you got to pay us off. It says in the covenants that we can make you do it, so yeah. Now, on the other hand, companies can actually put the bond or call it. And in a case like that, if interest rates fall, the first chance the company has to dump that bond, you better believe they're going to dump that bond as fast as they can so they can reborrow the money at a lower coupon rate. That is more or less the whole subject. There are some other things in the textbook I won't ask you on an exam. On an exam, as far as number question goes, you find me a price if I give you a yield. You find me a yield if I give you a price. That's what I'm going to ask you, okay? On a quiz or the final exam. Just a couple of questions. If you know how to key in the numbers, you got it. And you'll look like bond pricing geniuses. That is enough of that subject. This is, as I said, back a long time ago, I could give you bond quotes all day long. But anymore, you can't find places where they quote bonds simply because bonds just, I mean, they're not exciting. Mostly institutional investors and older individuals buy bonds. The rest of the world stays away from them. And so finding your quote stuff on those can be really difficult. Especially I used to just pull numbers up on the overhead and say, well, find the yield to maturity on this bond. They'd list the bond and all of its characteristics. Or find the price, and I'd show you the yield to maturity. You can't even find bond quotes much anymore because of these things. But do know this, that when a company gets into trouble, that's when its bond starts selling at a deep discount to par, simply because the risk is going up. So the investors are throwing higher and higher interest rates on that, the yield to maturity. They're saying, if CVS is getting into trouble, the investors are going to say, well, we want 5%, 6%, 7%, 8%. And so what that does is that mathematically drives the price down so that the bond is tailing down to deep discounts to par. There are always other variations on this as well, too. But that's when you get junk bonds, because you'll see the bond pricing at $600, $700, $800. Heck, I saw one last night that was selling at $300 simply because the yield to maturity had skyrocketed because investors were saying, this is so risky, we really want a lot of money if we're going to throw it at this kind of trash. Similarly with Netflix, when it issued its bonds, in order to keep them at par when they were sold initially, they had to put the coupon way high to mollify investors who were worried about Netflix being able to pay its interest payments. So there's that part of it too. Just a side story from a long, long time ago. I don't know if I should even... Back before the modern era, One of the ways that the bad guys or the shadowy people had of getting their money, their ill-gotten gains, was that they would say, you pay me in bearer bonds, B-E-A-R-E-R, bearer bonds. Now, a bearer bond was the way it was always done. You literally got a book, and inside were these, they look sort of like checks. They were coupons, coupon requests. You tore one out, you sent it to the company, and that meant you were the bearer, and so the company sent you the money. That was a bearer bond. And they were a very popular thing for bad guys, because essentially all you had to do was pull out the coupon, use some fictitious name, and you got a check from the company. And they finally ended the era of the bearer bonds. They're not around anymore. So they've had to find other ways to get their ill-gotten gains. But in fact, even ransom was sometimes paid in bearer bonds, because it was, you say, well, why didn't they get it in cash? Because cash could always be printed that has serialized numbers that could be identified to catch the bad guys. Bearer bonds were like an opaque curtain. And so they, drug dealers used them, kidnappers used them all the time. And they're not around anymore, so now we have to use cryptocurrencies and all of that. But anyway. Let me take you on here and go to our next subject, which is risk and return. Now, Wednesday, I may have a guest speaker to talk to you about risk and return. I'm not saying that it will be anything strange. You know that things like that don't happen in this class, but it's possible that there could be something difficult happening. But the bottom line is that this is one of the most fundamental principles in all of finance, is the relationship between risk and return. But it's actually, the trick is that it's not return, it's expected return. And it's not exactly risk, it is what risk you can't get rid of, what we call systematic risk. So let me write this on the board here. The relationship in its simplest form says the greater the risk, the greater the return. But that's not exactly right. You need two qualifiers. Be careful on a quiz or an exam, because I'll give you four different statements. And you have to make sure that you know which one is actually the right one. It is not really the risk. It is the non-diversifiable, otherwise known as the systematic. Risk. You should not ever expect a reward for risk that you don't have to take, that you could remove. That's not true in some environments. I would point you to movies like those ones where people do stupid things and they nearly die. Okay? Say what?
Tropic Thunder.
Well, yeah, I suppose that would. Or the fail videos. For example, 2 weeks ago I decided I would have a barbecue outside. So I started the propane, turned on the gas valves, and then I realized that the ignition switch was worn out. So I went in the house and I looked around and I finally found a match. Now, let me point out that there were probably about 3 minutes of propane gas building under the cover of my very nice Grill Master when I tossed in the match. Hence why I have the haircut. In my defense, the kids that were around me think I'm a hero now. But the greater the expected return, because you don't know what is going to happen. You actually don't know. You expect something to come out of what you're doing. So, madam, I've seen you drive. You drive like a blind trout.
I am blind.
You are a maniac on the road. I mean, you know, yeah.
100 points for each person you have.
No. Easy. Whoa. I mean, damn. No. I did a.
True has no correlation.
I think I still have the video up where I was coaching people on doing presentations, and I told them not to do your presentation to me while you're driving. And what happened with me was I actually almost hit some skateboarder. I mean, you can even hear him in the background screaming at me, asshole! Anyway, so it's the expected return, not the actual return, because we don't know when we take an action. But you're driving like a maniac because you want the greater return of getting to your destination 5 seconds earlier.
That makes sense. That's the okay? Place.
Yeah, but you don't know that's going to happen. You expect it to happen, but in fact, you could have a policeman, you know, has his radar out and he catches you. Or, you know, at a higher speed, you could have a blowout and do a lot of property damage. So, in other words, this is not about returns. In our world, we don't know what's going to happen. Now, if it's a few seconds, we're pretty sure, a few minutes. But in general, this return that we're talking about here is speculative. It goes up as we are not going to take a risk if there's not something in it for us. We don't know that that's what's going to come out of it, but we are hoping that that's what's going to come out of it. So, for example, this is the one that you would want to answer on a quiz. The greater the non-diversifiable, the expected, rather the systematic risk, the greater the return that you expect from it. So just keep that in mind. Now, the word risk. It's nice to talk about risk, but we need it in a numerical way. We need to tighten up. Now, there are risks that are just obviously there. We don't know what's going on. You, madam, you want to become part of my ghost hunting club, right? Okay. Now, we can talk about risk in that way. We can't measure risk, But it usually we know when we have gotten into a bad situation. Because shortly after something says, get out of my house, we're all running out the door screaming like Scooby-Doo. So there's that kind of. In fact, have any of you ever been to Disney World? They have something called the Tower of Terror. Yes. I went up there to the top. This was back a long time ago when they didn't have this thing called safety procedures. And they're and I just keep seeing these doors opening, and then suddenly there's nothing but darkness. And then clear at the top, they opened the doors. You know what I saw? I saw dead relatives. And then they let go, like that. And if that weren't bad enough, when you're leaving, trying to, you know, put yourself back together, they're showing you pictures of what you looked like on the way down. My cheeks were up here above the top of my head. Okay, there is a risk, but I can't exactly measure it, maybe by heart rate, I suppose. But you see, and oftentimes in our common language, we see or we identify risk, but we don't really appreciate it in a numerical way. This risk is greater than this risk. In finance, we have to have clear numbers as metrics of risk. And we'll get into those in the lecture on Wednesday. But in the case like this, this risk right here, I will say, start it out like this. Risk more than one possible outcome. That's what it boils down to. If there is only one outcome that can happen, then there is no risk involved. It's only if more than one outcome can happen that there is such a thing as risk. So when I buy a stock, there are many outcomes. So and as those outcomes become more varied, the risk goes up. So more than one possible outcome. Variation. I've got all these markers, and I'm fine for the rest of this year. Variation in outcomes . That's a part of the risk, too. That's a very important part of risk, is how varied. Well, we could have two outcomes, but they're very similar, so that's not really much risk. It's as those outcomes become more and more different from each other that there is more risk involved. So the variation in outcomes plays into it, too. Now, let's try this. A simple coin toss. Outcome. Payoff. Now, if it comes out heads, the payoff is a dollar. If it comes up tails, the payoff is nothing. Now, the probabilities. If it's a fair coin, then there is a 0.5 probability of a head and a 0.5 probability of a tail. So in other words, there is risk in this game. The coin toss game has a risk. There is a variation in outcomes, two different outcomes. Now, the expected payoff is pretty simple to calculate. The way we always do it is we do the probability of each outcome times the payoff to the outcome. Whoops. So the expected payoff to this game is 50 cents. Now, getting a little bit more into the numbers of it, if you were willing to pay 50%, 50 cents to play this game, we would say that you are risk neutral. If you would be willing to pay nothing, if you were willing to pay no more than 49 cents, you are risk averse. In other words, you would pay 0 to 49 cents to play this game. That would be a risk averse person. And the less you would pay, be willing to pay, the more risk averse you are. Now, interestingly, if you would be willing to pay more than 50% for this game, you are risk preferring or risk loving. You're willing to pay more than the expected outcome. Taken the other way, I'm working at the Carney, and I say, 50 cents for this game. You play this game, tails, you get nothing, heads, you get a dollar. But I'm charging you 50 cents for this game. We would say that that is a fair game because the cost of entry equals the expected value of the outcome. That is what we call a fair game. And if it's, yeah, I charge you 40 cents, then that's what's called a superior game. Or if I charge you more than 50 cents, it's an unfair game. And in fact, carnies work this way. We know what the probabilities are of wins and losses. And we know, and the same thing is true in casinos too. This goes to the old rule of casinos and brokers. The house always wins because the expected value, what you pay for entry, is going to be more than the expected outcome. The closest you come to a fair game at a casino is 21. That's why they've got cameras all over the place to make sure you're not one of those people who can do the counting, figure out how many times the jack has shown up and all that. Huh? Well, roulette. I mean, roulette is a very unfair game. Roulette? I never won at roulette, but that's because I'm a loser overall, for God's sake. But anyway, 21 is the closest to a fair game in a casino. At least it used to be. And that's why anymore they can't let anyone have an edge because it gets too close to a fair game and the house does not want that to ever happen. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.